Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Those of you who are here in metropolitan New York certainly cannot have missed the exciting, some say dismal, opening of the new arena on Flatbush here in Brooklyn. Well, Brooklyn hasn't had a professional sports team since the Dodgers left a long time ago. And so now there's a basketball team here, and there is a new Barclays Arena. And the architects of the Barclays Arena, Shop Architects, S-H-O-P, have been widely quoted and interviewed. That's the Sharpless brothers and Kimberly Holden and Greg Pascarelli. And I thought that it would be appropriate to have a, shall we say, a reprise, a repeat, listen in on an interview that I had with them way back at the very beginning of doing this program. Back in August 2009, Barclays Arena wasn't even on the horizon, but I was very interested in speaking with Bill and Chris Sharpless. And by the way, you will notice that I continually and repeatedly mispronounce their last name, calling them Sharples. But that's okay, because they were on the radio with Brian Lehrer last week, and Brian continually mispronounced their name. So, hey, we all make mistakes. Let's listen into what Bill and Chris Sharpless had to say about architecture, the doing of the deed, and taking responsibility for making it constructible. Let her roll. We are Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, a continuing conversation about architecture in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, passions, and ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. This evening in studio, our guests are Bill and Chris Sharpless, the name brand, top of the billing founders of Shop Architects, which stands for your group name, I guess. It's everybody who's related to everybody is related to everybody is Shop.
That sounds good.
Which includes the two of you.
Yes, and we have three other partners, Greg Pascarelli, Kimberly Holden, and Corey Sharpless.
So the S is Sharpless, is obviously H Holden. O, there's no O. It's just an empty spot. And P for Pascarelli.
That's great. And also with us this evening is our guest interlocutor, Professor Rod Knox. Hey, Rod.
How are you?
Okay. Speak up, man. So one of the things that I wanted to talk with our Shop Architects about is something that seems fairly, even in this day of high technology, a fairly rare thing. Architects who apparently design buildings that can be built without a great deal of interpolation. Let's talk about the normal or typical path of a set of drawings and how that goes into production and construction.
Well, within the context of Shop or the traditional way?
Well, let's start with traditional, and let's talk about how your point of view is perhaps a little more innovative and different.
Well, I would like to sort of say it's sort of the way we worked and sort of critique the tradition or the practice of doing architecture came out of our education at Columbia in the early 90s. And one of the things that we learned right away, well, first of all five partners came from very diverse undergraduate backgrounds. None of us had a degree, undergraduate degree in architecture. And so when we all decided on our own to become architects and go to Columbia to get a master's degree, a first professional degree, we just assumed that when you got that degree that you would go do a design and then you would go execute that design. What we learned quite quickly in school was that wasn't necessarily the priority or the goal of one's education. There was a lot of things going on around us at that time. Post-structuralism was definitely at its pinnacle, and understanding how things went together wasn't necessarily a priority. So but there was definitely people who were teaching us who were seeing that there needed to be a change and that had to be addressed. I think Bernard Schumi was critical in that sense. He was the dean. He became the dean when we started at Columbia, and he emphasized the importance about architects trying to take back some territory.
And that's a very good thing. In my own observation of the state of architectural education is that still no one's teaching the connections, how things go together, what materials want to commingle, and others which must be kept apart.
Yeah, but before you can even get into that, you have to create an attitude, a desire, a sense that you are capable of actually embracing and taking on those challenges.
Or willing.
There's always that, oh, the suites catalog or the manufacturer's warranty. There's all this liability. Oh, you can't go out on a limb and test out new ideas or innovate or work with craftspeople because there's all these legalities that are beholden to. And so it's all about attitude. How can I actually be quite involved with manufacturers and fabricators and craftspeople in developing designs from the ground zero point of view and not necessarily having to take something off the shelf?
Yeah, and one of the things that I like to pose as a question for myself is, what does it take to be a master architect? Is it a knowledge of materials? Is it a deep immersion in the history of design? Is it having a visionary passion that knows no bounds and defies gravity or practicality? Is it all of the above? Is it none of the above?
I think it's all of the above. I think, first of all, good liberal arts education is critical. I mean, to think holistically, you can't just do, 10 semesters of studio.
Why not?
Because that's just one facet, We learn.
You mean simply 10 students?
No,
of course.
We've taught at different schools and found that, it's not required that you take a philosophy course or that you take language studies. You don't take theology. These are outside of the discipline of a lot of academies when it comes to design. And
I couldn't agree more. Now, I don't know what you took, Rod, at Cooper, but I was quite lucky in that I had comparative religion from Professor Bowman, who was this grand old Quaker.
That's good.
And okay.
We're Quakers.
Okay, well, peace be with you.
a moment of silence.
I filled most of my discretionary credits, earning the equivalent of a minor in art history that was focused on theater, which leads me to now want to do radio because it's a little performance every week, but it's sharing something that's very vital and important to me and to a lot of the people that we know in the world, although a lot of people don't seem to care one way or the other about architecture. They just really have blinders. And we'll get to that later. But so you were describing the environment that you came out of where you weren't really prepared to draw a wall section.
Not only that, it's not even so much that, is that we weren't prepared to think that we could actually execute what we designed.
Well, who was supposed to take care of that then?
Well, basically, there would be people out there that would help us. And that's why you had that three-year sort of internship before you can actually take the
exam. But I think it goes back to
For our listeners, traditionally or legally, one must have at least a 5-year degree in architecture,
right,
or a 3 or 3.5 year master's, all adding up to 8 years of training. The last 3 years traditionally being internship or apprenticeship, and now that's regulated under the IDP, the Intern Development Program, where young graduate architects must be exposed to certain aspects of the profession in order to be permitted to take the last portion of the licensing exam. Now, in reality, 3 years is really just a toe dipped in the water, because architecture is a lifelong learning experience, which is why crafty old architects are often very good. Sometimes they get beyond being good and get a little, you know, just loosey-goosey, but it's my hope and intention that perhaps we represent a new approach towards the practice of being truly master architects. And so that informed your decisions as to how you would organize your practice.
Well, I think it just to, you know, reiterate this thing about kind of a renaissance or liberal arts education, because, you know, you just said 8 years of education, and you think about what it costs to send a child or person to school for 8 years, and the debt that incurs, and then you think of the return that you have in the practice of architecture. I mean, when I attended architecture, when I was a structural engineer, I graduated from Penn State in the 80s, worked in construction in Washington for about 5 years, attended Columbia, and we were in there, as Chris was talking, in this period in time where we were definitely in the paper architecture stage. There was no work, where we were in a recession, you know, late 80s, early 90s.
I can't remember when we weren't in a recession.
Well, no,
depending
it's
on
been,
who's,
it's
who
been
you're
very busy.
To.
But anyway, my point is that when I started there, I mean, a lot of people said, you know, this is a starving artist attitude. And my immediate reaction to that is that's completely wrong. I mean, when you look at it as a, you know, from a business standpoint, and I would say this is one of the things that drew all five of us together. You know, the practice in terms of what we're doing, what we're producing for our clients, but also in terms of how we look at ourselves in terms of what we're doing. And again, you know, Greg worked on Wall Street as a banker. My wife, Corey, worked in graphic design. Kim was historian. Chris, political science, fine arts. I, an engineer. Mm-hmm. We all came together. And this is a key point, that think about it. If you had five years of all the same training and you get in a room, it's all going to be about who's got the bigger ego, who's got the bigger mouth. In our office, it's because we come at it at so many different angles because of our background. And again, it's about education, a broad experience, travel, liberal arts.
Yeah, and basically drawing on these different skill sets.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it's sort of, these are the tools that we started off with, and how could we leverage them in helping us understand how we wanted to grow our practice. You know, I, as Bill was saying, I came from a fine arts background with political science, and so I did a lot of painting and printmaking. I went to Dickinson College, and it was fantastic. And then I went abroad for a year and studied in Bologna, and then realized I don't want to go into law. I want to be an architect. But when I came back and I started at Columbia, I bought all the accoutrements, all the equipment you needed to be an architect, the Mayline, all the eraser shields. But I still feel I can draw a straighter line freehand than I ever could with that Mayline. Actually, the Mayline always got in my way. And it was amazing, because I ended up taking an internship at Richard Meyer's office, and really that is the top when it comes to that level of precision using that kind of of equipment. But what was really important was I realized early on, and this might have something to do with our dyslexia, that certain tools, when they don't work for you, that they prevent you from exercising certain types of creative aspirations, you sort of have to put them aside, even if, you know, that's the tool that everybody's supposed to be using.
Yeah.
And that was really critical to us, that we realized maybe there's certain things about the way that this profession operated that didn't necessarily work for us. What are we going to do? What new tools will we craft to allow us to achieve our aspirations?
So did you invent your own tool set?
Well,
did you adapt it?
We evolved one based on tools that were there. But for example, a number of us, we all like to draw. We still draw on Trace. We use it as a tool to diagram and explain something. We use the computers for other in the same way, but for different reasons, for different roles. But the point is that when I draw, for example, I always draw in 3D. You know, I always want to I basically model. That's the way I like to draw.
I think anybody who has any experience with actually building or constructing, even carpenters will sketch an axonometric representation to figure out how certain joints work.
Right. And so it's really exciting that when we first did those first drawing sets, our first project was for this park out in Long Island, Greenport, we were required, you know, to put a drawing set. It had all the plans and all the elevations and all the sections. And we were really concerned whether this project would come in on budget, because we had to put it out to public bid.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was 10% over the prescribed budget, we would have to redesign free of charge. And so we were like, wow, this is going to be a problem, because we were doing this carousel house, and it had these 2-ton bifold glass steel doors. There was a set of
15 foot by 15 foot.
Yeah, a set of what was it, 6 or 12? And we're going, my God, yeah, I can just see everybody throwing a lot of fat at that one, all the contractors and stuff.
Yeah, that'll be $3.758 million.
Yeah, let's weigh the drawings and, yeah, and price accordingly. And so what we decided to do was say, how can we create a visualization device here that allowed these builders to really understand the intricacies of this design? So what we decided to do is we built a large model.
One and a half inch.
Scale. Yeah, of a pie shape.
Of one section.
And what we did is, as we were building it, we photographed the whole construction mm-hmm. sequence, and then we made this little book of photographs that described every phase of the construction of that model, and we used that as a reference device for the drawing set.
So did that go in the project manual?
Yes, it did. And for us, that was when we look back at that, and we still have the model in
the
office.
That's BIM 1998.
Yeah, that's version one BIM. that was the analog mm-hmm. model, you know, versus the digital.
But in some ways, it is perhaps more illustrative of what you were trying to convey in terms of information. I mean, my favorite approach to renovation work is to take a lot of photographs and draw over them and paste them up and scan it. Say, you know, here, caulk this. Don't paint this. Don't worry about this gap, you know? And that works very well. And it's very crude technology, but it's very direct.
It's very visual. You know, it's amazing when you look at a 2D drawing and it references another drawing, let's say a section or something. So you're moving from 2D to, you know, another dimension, well, another 2D. But in order to get there, you have to go through another dimension. And you just imagine how easy it is, if your mind isn't used to that kind of exercise, how you could really mess something up.
Well, that's supposing that the people either reading the documents or putting them together don't understand orthographic projection, which has now become a remedial course in the first year level of at least one school that I can think of. Now, you know, it's easy for me to sniff at that because I started learning mechanical drawing as a 14-year-old in high school, and I had 4 years of drafting before I stepped across the threshold at Cooper. So for me, yeah, it was vocational education,
But I got it out of the way, same as I learned how to write simple declarative statements pretty much in high school. These days, architecture schools end up being remedial in a very great degree, and at the same time, which mystifies me, don't want to send their kids out to scavenge hunt at Home Depot for something that's cool, unusual, and who knew what this did. If it was my architecture school, we'd spend a lot of time in lumber yards, mm-hmm. and salvage yards, and what, you know, what is this? What is that called? Because for me, it's like being a chef. The ingredients inspire the creation, and as a fully masterful architect, you have to know the possibilities of the materials, what the materials do, and what they don't do, and what they want. I mean, of course, there's a tradition. Lou Kahn said, I asked a brick what I wanted to be, and it said, I want to be an arch. There's a whole world. There's a universe of meaning in that. And so what I'm understanding, what you're telling me, is that by working with models and then sharing that information with the builders, you established a practice that was more proactive in terms of, how do we think this is going to be built? Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we've come to a place where it's a natural breakpoint. And when we come back, I want to ask you about some of the aphorisms that flash across the homepage of your website and what some of these things mean.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
And I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host, here this evening with Chris and Bill Sharples, Rod Knox, and we're just a bunch of architects hanging out, talking about what we do, how it could be better, what's the point of, you know, what's it all about, Alfie? As architects, I think we find ourselves asking ourselves, you know, what are we doing? What should we be doing? What do we really do? How do we bring value to the environment? Are we merely illustrators and the hard work of thinking falls to someone else? These are all things that all right-thinking architects that I know are from time to time concerned about. Don't you agree, Rod?
And listening to your experiences, I had an office. I don't like to say I don't have an office anymore, because I selectively take work. And that I found practicing architecture to be almost painful. I had a job that was a job that was about $15 million.
That's a good sized job.
Yeah, it was
at 6.5% gross fee. You could actually pay your rent.
Hardly. The city cheated me, but I on that job, because it got dragged out so long, I really wanted to address all those things that you brought up, Chris, and so. There was a big roll of drawings, and only five of those sheets were mine. Everything to build that building was done in five sheets, and I worked really hard to do it. I did all the drawings, to make it very simple. And the funny thing is, the simplicity actually was stunning to the contractor that he couldn't read it. I mean, he was accustomed to the old ways, and I made a lot of allowances for him to fudge things, you know, and it's, you know, combining glass block, the module of the glass block with the module of the brick. I left him a lot of leeway to you know, adjust. And he the window openings for it was all loose lintels, and he made a rigid frame. And you know, even though the shop drawing said not to, and it was just painful.
It's not 1937 any longer, and you can't do a series of drawings and expect a competent construction.
Yeah, but what in sort of following along what you're saying is, what if the process why you were doing those drawings, the person who was actually going to build it was next to you, and you were communicating with them?
I went further than that. I actually wrote my philosophy out on the cover sheet. What my intention, what made me do what I did. Mm-hmm. So that in case I wasn't there, they'd know what to do. And it was nothing was left to the imagination. It was there as clear as can be. But I think that money is made on complexity, not simplicity. And so, you know, it's sort of, I had, the structural engineer had maybe 30 sheets of drawings, and he could have done it in 5 sheets. But it looked like he did more work than I did. And so, you know, that was what put them off with the 5 sheets. They thought, I don't know what I'm doing, because I should have 50 sheets. And I now don't subscribe to any of the rules or things that I have this total disdain for the AIA, and I don't subscribe to their contract. And I have my own contract. I ask for 80% of my fee at the end of design development. I will do the rest for free, essentially. But and by that time, I know they're going to waltz off with the contractor. So I don't care. At this point, to see a job all the way through is a dream. You don't own it. It's not your money. You have no control. It's somebody else's, and you're there. If they want to use you for your knowledge, fine. And if they want, all I offer my clients actually is my integrity, and I will always tell them the way it is.
Now that's a pretty grim picture that you pose or paint for us. I would imagine that, Bill and Chris, that in your practice, you're doing a great deal of work in contract administration, construction administration. You may be, what percentage of your gross architectural fee would you?
Well, you know, the traditional, it's still, you know, the 5%.
Well, that is insufficient.
Well, no.
Wait. We're talking about construction administration.
I don't mean bidding.
Yeah, construction administration is 35% to 40%.
Yeah, and as well it should be.
Yeah, I mean,
but the AIA guidelines still carried at 25%.
Yeah, 25%.
You get killed.
We also, again, you know, a lot of things have evolved in the last few years in integrated project delivery, and we'll use the term building information modeling once, because for us that's a dated term. I mean, this relationship, this social. You know, we look at our relationship with our clients, our consultants, and our contractors as something as a collaborative, as a collective. And it's very much a social experience. And we use, you know, the tool of the computer, the 3D, the 4D, 5D model. That's the three-dimensional spatial model, the four-dimensional
is time,
the schedule, and the 5D being money.
Sure.
And link this into the model, into singular model. Why? Because the client has specific concerns and interests. The contractor has specific concerns and interests. And we, the architects, are focusing ultimately on, you know, the built environment. But in order to get people excited and vested in an idea, you have to be willing to speak on a degree on their terms or their language. And
when they bring in a contractor that's the lowest bidder, and you're stuck with this person that has got to make their money back because they gave an unrealistic bid, And it's downhill from there, you know. And a client doesn't want to hear the truth. A client doesn't want to hear what it's really going to cost. And when you tell them, they don't want to hear it. They want to hear the low bid. And they're going to stick it to the guy, and knowing that he can't do it for that amount of money. And it's off to a bad start. I mean, your role is to be the agent of both the contractor and the owner. You're in the middle, and you have to make sure they both behave themselves.
Well, that's a traditional supposition that the architect can be a dispassionate arbiter the design intentions of his own work or her own work.
But it tends to be adversarial in nature.
Yes, it does.
And that's the problem. The other thing is that a lot of people may not realize, but the architects in this room are quite familiar with it. Probably 1 out of 10 projects you design gets built, and for a lot of people, that's a pretty good batting average. Why is that? And why is it that most projects stop sometime, you know, in the middle or near the end of design development? Because the client finds out how expensive the project's going to be.
And I think Rod's right. If you know, if the first words that we would convey to them after "Hi, how are you?" is, you know, that this is going to cost $460.
But we don't say that. That's the thing.
you don't say that.
You start to work together and kind of build that environment. What's the design criteria? Yeah. What are the forces that are going to inform that? Obviously, cost is one of those forces.
Cost, time.
Architects, when we were in school, didn't care about that.
About
the concern of cost. The conversation when we were in school was, go back to your desk, draw it up, don't talk to anyone, come and present it, and hopefully the critics would love it. That is the wrong approach. The self-serving approach doesn't work. I mean, look, Frank Lloyd Wright could walk into a room and said, either you like it or you don't, I'm out of here. And to a certain degree,
I think that as architects, we're in a very bad place is because of the legacy of that role model. But on the other hand, the good guys in movies are almost always architects. I mean, Tom Hanks is some kind of designer in Sleepless in Seattle.
Well, there's George Costanza.
Yes, when he needed to get a date. And there's Woody Harrelson in Indecent Proposal, where he's actually presenting a rather nice lecture.
And Henry Fonda in 12 Angry
Charles
Man.
Bronson.
Oh, yes, where there's matched
Richard
pistols.
Gere.
And Richard... Which one was that?
I'm trying to think. He was definitely an architect. Oh, yeah. He was in the intersection, or the one... he was an architect in that movie. Actually, Richard Meyer coached him.
Was Howard Roark a good guy?
I think Gary Cooper played pretty good Howard Roark. I think what I really liked about that movie, and I didn't realize it until I'd seen it, how the architects were quite involved in understanding material sciences. I mean, the fact that part of your education was actually to go out and maybe work in a quarry and learn how to cut stone. And I think that's something that we try to bring to the table when we're working with clients early on, is how can we manage the issue of cost effectively without necessarily compromising the creative...
The design intention.
Yeah.
Sure.
And in order to do that, you really have to embrace that cost is going to impact whatever you do.
As a designer, you're taking responsibility for, you know what, we're going to build this together. I'm going to know how all the pieces go together before I even let you look at my documents.
No. You're going to show them.
If you do it,
you know,
while you're going along.
Yeah, this is an important thing is, you know, instead of, you know, you hear the story is, somebody knocks at your door and says, you know, I want you to build me a house. Here's my program. What really happens is a lot of clients aren't really sure what they want.
Of course.
And usually we start the whole process by asking questions. But sometimes, you know, asking, you know, what do you want isn't necessarily the right question. Usually the question that really gets people going is, what doesn't work for you? And suddenly they start telling you exactly what doesn't work. And as you start to understand what doesn't work, they start to tell you what they're looking for.
Now, of course, your website says you do everything except single-family houses.
That's correct. There was a time when we were doing that, but I think, you know, it's sort of like what Frank Lloyd Wright said.
We have enough problem with our family, right?
There's only so many closets you can do before you have to move on. But yeah.
Now, I wanted to talk about some of these... what we like to call aphorisms that appear on your website, and you know, if you want to, you know, squeal about this, that I'm holding you accountable for your website, then go right ahead. This is just random because, as you know, they randomly come up. How it's built doesn't matter, except when it's the only thing that matters. Is this apropos of what you're just describing of the collaborative environment of involving the owner, your client, and informing your client as to how their project is going to go together, and involving, if not the trades themselves, knowledge of the trades?
Absolutely.
Okay. Efficiency and great design are not mutually exclusive. I don't quite understand that. Efficiency what? Efficiency in the production of documentation?
No. What we're talking about there is, you know, one of the things that excites us or inspires us in our practice is looking at other industries and how they operate. For us, the aerospace industry has had a huge impact on the way we work and design in the office. And the fact is because if you come into our office, the first thing you're going to be greeted by is what we call our airplane walls. There's about 300 spotter ID aircraft flying right at you when you open the door. And a lot of people go, what the hell is that about?
Well, it's a great way to start in a conversation with a client.
Right. And the thing about it was...
In a world where... And carpenters love to do this, and I'm sure they've pulled this on you, where you have made an error in the drawings, and for some reason the auto dimension function showed something at 3'6" 3/16", and then the carpenter will show you a carpenter's pencil, and the point of the carpenter's pencil is a good quarter of an inch wide, and saying 3/16" doesn't exist in the world of construction.
Right.
But what you're conveying by that is that in the aerospace business, tolerances are in fractions of millimeters, and you hope to attain that kind of resolution in your work?
No, because we understand that there's different scales we operate at. The point I was going to go towards is the understand how important performance was to, you know, achieving, you know...
Performance of the building?
Yeah. The performance. It basically, anecdotally, to sort of say it simply, you know, Kelly Johnson, who was the founder of Lockheed Martin's research division, Skunk Works, said, you know, typically if the aircraft performs really well, it usually looks really good, too. And that's sort of the attitude we have. If we are able to attack all the criteria...
Yeah, but do you actually? That's a good point. I wanted to ask you this because your blurb sounds great. You know, you're a no nonsense firm. You follow the facts and you get things done and no fooling around. So why do your stuff look like Raphael Vignoli or Rem Koolhaas or that sort of thing? Why does no nonsense architecture look like this dilettante stuff? I mean,
or more to the point, because you know how buildings go together.
Yeah.
Do they have to be? And I'm thinking of your porterhouse project,
right.
And I'm disappointed that there isn't more color in it. I'm looking at what looks like a rain screen, and it looks like it's gray.
It seems dressed up. It seems like if it's no nonsense, it's dressed up because no nonsense is not. I mean,
is not whimsy.
Well, that's
it is no nonsense. That's the thing. I'm not clear on what we mean.
But for example, that's like saying, well, when I look at the British Museum at Yale that Kahn did, it's got no color in it. But the materiality of that raw metal.
It has a lot of color in the wood paneling. The outside.
Yeah, we're talking about the outside.
But the thing is, what we really sort of found really exciting about that project was the 6-story brick warehouse.
Right, the yellow brick,
yeah.
beige brick.
And you know, and with that that zinc comes in two colors, the light gray, the sort of the navy gray, and the sort of stealth F-117 black. And it's sort of, it's actually like, well, the old Bugattis.
The
yellow with the black. The thing is, it operates on the scale of
the
city.
But Bugattis always have a hood ornament, you know?
Yeah.
And
we
you needed some red in that.
The light plaid.
It seemed to me.
We
were talking about this earlier, before we went on air, about to what extent do the tools drive the design decisions? And that is something that might be interesting to talk about after we have a brief break. Which is another of your aphorisms that you have. Talking about buildings is fun. No, building buildings is better than talking about buildings. That sounds really Luddite. I mean, really, you know. Is that a jab at somebody, you know, like Peter Eisenman or?
No,
I think it's not. We love building models growing up. I mean, you know, you buy a model, you got excited, put it together, and then you put it up on the shelf and said, go get another model. I think the whole process for us, it's the energy for us is actually putting it together.
Well, Philip Johnson said, you know, making buildings is so much fun, who would ever want to go on vacation?
Well, actually, that's very true, too.
Yeah, we are skipping our vacation this August.
Yeah, but, you know.
So. And let's see if there are any other tasty bits here. To truly innovate, we integrate. I don't know if that's innovative or retro. I mean, really, I would like to see a return to the time when you walk around with a mason square.
Well, yeah, hey, that's part of it. You know, walking into a fabricator shop and understanding how their machines work is one way of us understanding what the rules of their craft are. But I think what we mean by, you know, that, what you just read, is that we realize that we limit our skill sets.
Absolutely.
The practice right now, you know, you go to a cocktail party and the first person comes up to you and says, oh, so you're an architect. So what kind of architecture do you do?
Yeah.
Or what kind of style do you operate in? We're like, hey, you give us a spoon to design, we'll design you a spoon. You give us a doghouse. Well, the fact is that we limit our playing field to certain sort of prescribed sets.
I mean, you don't, but
we don't.
Yes.
And that has a lot to do with liability issues. It has to do with knowledge sets. And what we found out early on is that we're bringing a lot of different knowledge sets to the table,
which inherently reduces liability.
Yeah,
it does, because there's more knowledge behind the creation of the ideas that are putting together the building.
Well, yes, some people would say by taking on more of those responsibilities, you're opening yourself up to more liability.
You know, we're open to liability anyway.
That's the point. Yeah.
If you're going to carry insurance, I mean, it's like having a car with wonderful insurance and never driving it.
Absolutely,
get out there, do it.
Yeah, and so the way that we deal with it is, why don't we just put it all out on the table? Let's make this process as transparent as possible so that even the client understands what the risks are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where people are able to embrace.
But I want to touch on your aesthetics. How you arrive at your aesthetics? Because your analogy of the airplane, I like it. I mean, where you don't find a razzle dazzle on airplanes. You don't find superfluous stuff.
You did when Howard Hughes was designing them.
Well, no, it wasn't razzle dazzle. I mean, maybe when the Germans were painting, they couldn't call
or Bert Rutan.
You know, but
I mean,
that's not razzle dazzle.
No, it's not. It's high performance.
It's high performance.
It's form follows performance.
But it has an aesthetic.
Oh no!
Point of view.
When the performance, when you nail that performance envelope, it's like when Watson and Crick were being interviewed, and they said, "How did you know this was it? It looks right."
Yeah, but do you think?
That reminds me of a Bucky Fuller thing saying, "When I'm working on a problem, I don't think about beauty, but when I'm done, if it's not beautiful, I know that I got it wrong."
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And if it's beautiful, it's probably right. And so this is what I have the problem with: is that why then dress it up? Where does that? How does that fit in? You know,
you're going back to Porter House looking too dressy for being.
No, you talk about con, and con is supposed to be what it is what it is. You know, and you know the served and the
and it is what it is, but it's more than what it is.
But here I'll use the Porter House as an example. Is to understand that, you know, form generation isn't just tied to a specific function. There's other issues. It could be political. It could be, you know, with the community. It could be economic. Obviously, if it's a development project, it's going to be economic. But it's also cultural. You know, the fact is, residential design
always convey the truth.
Right.
And as an engineer, you should know that, you know, when you how buildings stand up. You should you know very well that what's holding that building up, you know, there's wind bracing in there, there's all kinds of stuff.
Oh, absolutely. But the financial model of that building was that if we were on a street corner, in order to make it work, we needed to get 8 foot of air rights from the adjacent property in order to get the plan of the units to be viable as sellable condo units. Because you have the 15-foot setback and the 10-foot setback off the avenue. Mm-hmm. So the reason why that building cantilevers over to his adjacent isn't some sort of like, oh, that would be cool.
I'm not taking exception to that.
No, but see, that's the secret. This is where we come to the issues of visual education and understanding, you know, when people look at an airplane, I'm sure there's a lot of people go, well, I don't know why it flies. Maybe because it goes so fast. But, you know, or why does my car work the way it does? You know, it's not the Art Deco model where if I make the train look like it's going fast, it's going to go fast. This is the model of that building is really based on understanding what the zoning issues are and what how you set up a residential plan that is able to
financially viable.
Yeah, financially viable.
And I'm sure it excels at achieving all of those solutions.
No, but the cultural side of this.
I'm not sure that I would endorse your being so meek in not attempting to upstage the brick warehouse with a coloration that was in the same color wheel.
Well, I mean, is this some form of contextuality that we're searching out here?
Well, I think you've kind of created. You know the early Michael Graves stuff where he'd take it was a regular house, and then there was this Martian collage kind of Kurt Schwitters thing sitting in the backyard, and it was a living room addition. I think you've achieved the inverse of that by being so respectful of the original streetscape as to have become invisible, and I just wonder.
Well, you know, in a Japanese way, you know, it is a kuroke kabe, and it is dark, and one could argue that it has become invisible in one sense. But you know, it comes back to...
Did you become so in love with the zinc that you were, you know, loving the zinc and maybe...
No, the zinc was the material that would allow us to achieve a certain desire that we had for this project. One was that we were getting sick and tired of looking at residential design of city as an extrusion of the same goddamn floor plate all the way up.
And the variegation of your facade panels.
The image...
is the best part of that.
Yeah. But you know,
did you study that in a 3D model?
No. You know what got that facade? What inspired us? It was actually an Ellsworth Kelly piece, a shadow drawing that he had done of shadows going through a wooden roof hitting a wall. And we looked at that and we said, there's something amazing about that because you could turn it this way and you look at there's so much variation. It sort of comes back to what Ruskin was saying. In order, you know, great architecture sort of has to have three sort of characteristics to make it great.
Right. John Ruskin being... For those who haven't an education in art history, John Ruskin, English writer and critic, very important, especially in the pre-Raphaelite period, the arts and crafts era, that is the 19th century arts and crafts era.
And he said there was like three certain qualities that, you know, you needed to really make architecture, and one was this concept of intricacy. Another was variability and variation. And the thing about that was is that you always look for structure in things, but at the same time, it's not like a grid. That you, when you walk into a cathedral, you start to see how that organic form comes together, and you sort of can measure yourself against it. And as you go back, you learn more about it. And so when we were looking at that Kelly piece, we're going, there's something really remarkable about it. It's sort of the same field condition, but it's made up of so much variations in it, and they can be quite intricate. And we thought, that's sort of exciting. I mean, it sort of brings us back to what we saw, you know, trips in other countries like Hong Kong, in Old Kowloon, where you saw all these different balconies and everybody sort of had their own identities. And we thought it would be really neat if we could actually start to generate that kind of variety in a facade. We knew we couldn't do that in brick. There's so many different building materials out there that wouldn't allow us to generate that kind of variety. And we actually talked to our roofing contractor one day, and we said, how could we actually, you know, basically take a roof idea and actually use the metal panel and develop a system that would be cost effective and allow this kind of variety? And he said, well, if you looked at it as a rain screen system, where you actually didn't necessarily use the zinc as your primary weather seal. Mm-hmm. You actually put it out. And then he said, then you could start to, you know, take the standard sheet size, which is about 1 meter by 3 meters, and start to play with that. Start to create a family. And in this case, we created a family of 15 sizes, and then 4 different window sizes. And then we had to...
So is it a glass facade behind that?
There's four different window sizes that are nested into
a rain screen,
and then start to build up a language based on this kit of parts. And so we understood, we were working with the roofing contractors. He told us what the return bent returns needed to be. Mm-hmm. How, for example, we found that, you know, to keep the pigeons off, we got in touch with the Smithsonian
Natural History Museum,
and they told us it was I was 38 degrees. If you had that inclined, the pigeons wouldn't roost there.
Or you could put owls up there.
Or yeah, but there's no poop on the building, and the building's been there for 6 years. So, and then the other thing was, you know, well, we'll do the drawings then. Since we learned, we received this education from this subcontractor, we started doing the drawings, and we actually bought the raw material from France through VM Zinc and had it shipped directly to Maloya Laser out in Riverhead, Long Island. We emailed basically the shop drawings right out to his machines, and they laser cut and digitally broke all those pieces.
Based on your design documents.
Yeah, and in order to, it was like putting a puzzle together.
Mm-hmm.
Each piece was scribed with the notation to tell you exactly where it went.
When you look at that in the end, can you say that is eloquence?
I don't know. You know, there are certain types of... No, because we actually have another project that I think is on the same page.
No,
the Mulberry. I think here's...
Yeah,
Mulberry. Mulberry is a brick building.
Yeah.
It's on corner of Houston and Mulberry. Had to be contextual in terms of its material. Yet, it's right across the street from Puck Building, one of the greatest brick buildings in New York City. And going back to your question in terms of like, well, how do you read the building? Well, I'll tell you. The thing about architect... And this is one thing we tell our
Mulberry
students...
Mulberry Street. You have a really interesting and intricate, almost like a waveform, but in
cast in yeah, it's
brick panel.
Brick, yeah. Yes, I think before I get into
that I think could only have been.
That's what if
a creation through a computer assisted.
Well, we'll get into the specifics of that similar to Poorhouse, okay. But I think what's interesting about the two buildings is I think like any piece of architecture. It changes. It changes in light. It changes after a rainstorm. It has an impact in the winter versus the sun. There are moments when I look at the Porterhouse, and it could be at 4 o'clock on a hot summer day, and gosh, that just looks, it's rough. I'm not comfortable with it. It's like a Rauschenberg piece. There's good moments, there's bad. And then on a dusk night, right after a rainstorm, and the lights are just coming on, it's ephemeral. It's magical. And I think, and I would just want to add.
Because it's wet.
Well,
no, but
But I want to add, make a point on this, because I would like, when we were growing up and we would go to our grandfather's place, we would always go by this building, and Bill and I are like, wow, that looks like a castle. And we later, when we were in school, we realized it was Lou Kahn's Bryn Mawr dormitories. That's not a very eloquent
that's
building.
That's the first building I dreamed about.
But that building, when it's wet, or it just starts getting wet, you get this modeling of water. When it's dry, it reads very differently.
I disagree. I think it is eloquent.
Well, I'll say what Porterhouse is. I think Porterhouse is playful.
I'll grant you that.
And I think it's like children's blocks.
I want to just add to that, if I may. Give me a second. It's, larksome and playfulness is fine, you're allowed to do it, but I'm saying that how do you square with your philosophy looking in at your work, I would say I probably would be better off without the razzle dazzle,
this is my two cents.
I want to know the razzle dazzle.
I think that you were too restrained with that building. I think that if you'd had some more color, it'd be more interesting. But that's my point
of view.
It's
a kind of incredible. I guess the point
what I hear you say is that because buildings live in the weather,
they live in their environment. And the great thing about...
From day to day, the building is different.
Another experience, it's important to... And this is why people have to travel. This is why it takes 8 years. This is why you do not leave high school and go to architecture school. You go and pursue...
Sorry, I did.
Yes. And, it's very difficult. And when we were teaching up at City College, you're working with students that are 18 years old, and they're trying to understand the big idea.
Holding down a part-time job,
too. Holding down. But I guess the point is, we travel through Europe, and there's another moment. Rudolf Steiner's Göttingen. Mm-hmm. Came upon this building right after a thunderstorm. It was just, the clouds had just cleared, and the light just hit it.
That's a black building, isn't it?
No, it's concrete. It's got some slate. But the point is, it was amazing at that moment, and then we got up there, and the clouds covered, and it was just ominous. It was just overpowering. Some parts of the building, proportions are not right. It's like amateur hour at some portions, and at other moments, wow, look at the craftsmanship. I think that's, again, what we're trying to say here, it makes you think. It makes you like it or love it. There are lots of, and again, I don't think what we're producing is anywhere near a gimmick or a style. It's based on like a relationship we have with our builders, our clients, our place, the place where it's being constructed,
the city of New York.
I think that you have an obligation not only to yourself, not only to your client, but you do have all architects, not just you, have an obligation to the public. That building is going to be there for maybe 100 years,
absolutely.
It's not just putting things together and people have to live with what may be a happy accident or a disaster. And so I think that if you your job as an architect is within just that little bit of leeway that you've given to take liberties, you say something
hold on to that thought. We have run out of time today.
Wah, wah.
We have a sound effect just like that. Are either of you or some combination of S, H, and P available to come back next week?
You should get Corey and Greg. I think you'd get two other partners and kind of get yet another.
Can we continue this next week?
I don't know if we can continue.
No, it's probably September. Sorry.
There's vacation in there right now.
No.
We'll talk about
schedule.
It offline. Because, we could go for another hour, but...
I think that's what separates the architects from the builders. People can build, and it can be efficient, and you can satisfy a program. But it's really not. I mean, it's a philosophy that makes it architecture. It is, like I say, eloquence. I mean, that you say, this is my work, and it, you can't destroy it. You know, it's something that you didn't give in all the way to the pragmatics.
No, I think I think we have to grant them the creation of architecture in the mindset of Mies, who said, when you put two bricks together carefully, then architecture.
And I'm encouraging them to stick with it and not to succumb to the
We hope that we can speak with you again soon. This has been Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, and we are here at the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.